Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I want to, in this last talk, give you kind of an overview of how human happiness flows out of human nature. And you have to understand a little bit about human nature, the different powers of a human being, in order to understand why happiness is what Aristotle says it is. And then I'll, at the end, say something about how that flows into Christian faith and how the coming of Christ elevates our nature so that we can attain to what is the true happiness for a human being. Because, of course, Aristotle being a pagan, only saw a glimpse. You might say, I mean, Aristotle was obviously one of the greatest geniuses ever to live, but he couldn't see, without revelation, he couldn't see through to what perfect happiness really is for us. So, I don't know how much of this will be reviewed for you guys, but I think it's really cool. And you might ask whether it's true. I think the way to decide whether Aristotle's understanding of the human person, Aquinas' understanding of the human person is true, is to consult your experience and ask, does this match your experience? So, what I want to do is I want to start with what we call the sensitive soul. Okay, so this is the powers of the soul that we share with all other animals. Okay, so all animals have powers that are divided. The generic object of the power of our powers are two: truth and goodness. Okay, now we share this with all animals. So the two sort of kinds of powers that correspond to these two are, so this is generic powers. Okay, when I say generic, it implies that, so a genus versus species. So when you have a genus, you're always going to have species underneath it, different kinds underneath it. So animals, you're going to have rats, snakes, dogs, human beings, right? Different species underneath it. Likewise, with the powers of a human being, the generic object is truth and goodness. The generic powers, okay, so at a high level, the kinds of powers that we have are cognitive. Okay, so this is knowing powers. And what are called appetitive. Appetites, right? Desiring powers. Now, you can't desire something you don't know anything about. Okay, I don't know. That's sort of a starting point that we can't. If we don't know something, we can't desire it. So, for example, I have here a donut that I kept from lunch and somehow avoided not eating, even though it was sitting on my desk, which was not the best idea to preserve the donut. Somehow, I managed to preserve the donut. I love donuts. So, if I did not know that there was a donut here, I couldn't desire the donut. Okay, now, as soon as I see the donut, now, of course, I see the donut, I'm not necessarily getting bodily pleasure from seeing it, just kind of round with little crumbles on it, right? But I've eaten donuts before. My imagination, so seeing the donut brings into my imagination, ah, good, right? The taste of the donut. Now, if I knew nothing about the donut, if I just saw a circle there, there wouldn't be any particular desire. Unless, of course, I could smell the donut. Then I'm like, oh. Then all of a sudden, my desire triggered. So these sorts of powers, the appetitive powers, always respond to the cognitive powers. You can't desire something you don't know. Okay, does that make sense? All right, so those are the generic powers that we have in common with all animals. Each of these powers has a particular causal role. So, causal role. Now, how many of you are familiar with the four causes of Aristotle? Or have heard of them before a little bit? Some people? Okay. You don't necessarily have to know the ins and outs of that to understand this. So,
truth, the causal role that truth plays in human life, or in any animal life, is it provides the final cause, or the end. Okay, now, it is by knowing the donut that I come to know what the goal of my desire is. Okay, so the donut, knowledge of the donut through my senses is going to tell me what I want. I smell the donut and I'm like, ah, and I'm pulled towards it. Now, the reason I say ah instead of oh, that is good, is because we're talking about the senses here. So they don't know things conceptually. Like when I smell the donut, I may be thinking about what donuts are like intellectually, but if I weren't a human being, I couldn't do that. And we're just talking about the senses right now. So I smell it and I'm like, oh, I detect sense pleasure coming, right? And my appetite reaches out for it. So the knowledge of my senses, my smell, provides the final cause, the goal, the thing I'm reaching for. And the appetite provides the efficient cause. Okay? It pushes. I'll just say it. The push. All right, so smelling the donut by itself, just the raw data of smelling it, doesn't push me toward the donut. It's my desire in response to that smell that makes me go, like that, okay, that pulls or pushes me in that direction. So the efficient cause is something, you know, efficient cause is the thing that's most familiar to us among causes. It's what we usually think about when we say causes. So me moving this chalk up, I'm the efficient cause of the chalk going up. I'm the efficient cause here of the donut moving across the podium here. You can't see the donut, I guess, because it's slanted, but trust me, it's there. So, okay, so each of those provide a different, they play a different causal role. The knowledge provides me with the end, and appetite provides me with the get up and go to go after the end. Okay. All right, now, specifically, what are the powers we're talking about when we're talking about the sense powers? So sense powers, these are shared with all other animals. All other animals have these. Okay, here we have the senses. Okay, now, this includes the imagination as well. So what we're going to say is internal and external. My sight and my smell are external senses. My memory of what the donut tastes like and my imagination that can kind of reproduce what the donut tastes like, that is what Aristotle and Aquinas would call an internal sense. Okay, and so it also can provide data, as it were, for desire because that data is stored. I've experienced it before. Dogs can do this too, right? A dog can remember something without smelling anything. If a dog saw, you know, steak or something, could remember what that steak looks like and be attracted to it. And then over here, what we have is we have the appetites, also known as the desires or emotions or passions. Those are all roughly equivalent. Now, the object of the senses is knowledge, sense knowledge. Okay, so things like color, somewhat indirectly shape, sound, taste, smell. The object of the appetites are sense pleasure. Okay, so basically food, sex, sleep, whatever other pleasures we get from the senses. And the senses here recognize the good. Like I can recognize the good smell of the donut. And my appetites pull me towards it. Now, for a non-rational animal, like for a dog, what the animal does is going to be, as it were, the vector sum of its desires. Okay, so if you've done science or math and know what a vector is, essentially, whichever desire is strongest is going to win out. So, for example, I put a steak in front of a dog. The dog is not going to resist the steak. A steak the smell of the steak is too good. The dog desires the steak. If assuming the dog is hungry, it's going to go after the steak. It's not like the dog says, that steak has a lot of fat on it. And, you know, I've really been trying to cut back on my lipid intake. No, the dog can't think that way. The dog is just going to, it's going to smell the steak. You're like, memory says these are really good. Goes after it. But here's another case. So I had a little dog when I was a kid. I had the only dog I ever owned is a miniature dachshund named Trouble. Now, Trouble, so it happened that, this is a complicated story a little bit, but there was another dachshund in the neighborhood that was in heat, female dog. And Trouble would cross the streets, the freeway, in a very dangerous way to get to this other dog. And had gone over there a few times, and we had punished Trouble. We had said, no, don't go. Trouble had groveled. And, you know, he'd been punished enough. Now, one morning, Trouble took off. Now, Trouble had a choice, in a way, right? Trouble did have the memory of being punished, and he doesn't like the disapproval of his master, right? And so there's something that he's remembering that is a consequence of going after this other dog. But he also had his very strong physical desire. And so the question is just going to be, which one of those is stronger? And you can probably guess which one was stronger, because I went after Trouble and found Trouble in the front yard, and it was, as it were, too late. The both of the dogs were there. And yeah. This story is actually has more parts to it, because it turns out that the other dog was actually owned by a girl in my class that I had a crush on. This was like in early high school. Anyway, it was a very awkward moment when like she came out at like 6 a.m. and like, oh, yeah, I guess we'll just wait. Anyway, the point is, it's possible for the dog not to obey its first desire, right? If the dog like believes that there's going to be a consequence from memory, right? From remembering being punished or something like that. It didn't work in that case. So it's important to see that these powers are independent, or interdependent on each other. So if you can imagine, you might ask the question, well, could you have an animal that only has cognitive powers? What would that be? Well, without desires, the animal wouldn't do anything. So what would an animal with just cognitive powers be? It would be like a little blob that sits there and sees the world, or hears the world, or smells the world, but is completely apathetic about everything. Any data of its senses that comes in just doesn't respond, because it has actually no desires at all. Right? Nothing to make it move, or even if it has the ability to move, it would do nothing. And so it's kind of like, I described this to one of my students when I was teaching in Houston, and she said, that's like worse than being a rock. I think the idea was that like you can sense things, but you're just completely apathetic. You have no desire to respond to the senses. So Aquinas seems to think that this is impossible, that you couldn't have an animal. And I think it's impossible in the following sense, that nature does nothing in vain, and having senses would be in vain if we had no desires. On the other hand, if we had desires but no senses, we also wouldn't do anything, because we wouldn't have the end. We'd have no goal. I wouldn't be able to smell the donut or see the donut or have any information about the donut or anything else I might desire. And so you need both of these kinds of powers in order for an animal to act, to want to act and to do so. Okay, now, one thing we could ask is, are dogs or other sorts of animals that are not human, are they free? Do they have freedom? And you might think, well, it seems like not, because they're just obeying their passions. But what Aquinas says is they have a certain share in freedom. Why? Because even though ultimately it's going to be the strongest desire that's going to win, still, they act according to knowledge. They act in response to knowledge. And so even though it's just bodily desires that they act on, there's still a kind of freedom, because they're responding to knowledge about the world. We can compare this to a tree. If a tree, as we assume, doesn't have senses, the tree can reach out its roots to the water, which is just part of its nature,
But the tree isn't responding to information coming in through senses because it has no senses. And so the tree doesn't act from knowledge. And so the tree has no, it doesn't have freedom in anywhere. But Aquinas would say that they have a kind of freedom, a kind of freedom proper to their nature, in as much as they respond to the senses. They have senses and they can respond to them. And then what would we say is the happiness of a non-rational animal, of an animal that only has these powers, only has these sorts of powers? Well, its happiness is to achieve the ends that its desires are meant for. What are those ends? Bodily pleasure. Right? Bodily flourishing is going to be the end of the animal. Now, of course, domestic animals, this is a problem, right? Because they don't have anything in their environment that's going to prevent them from, you know, eating too much of something that's unhealthy for them. So we humans can just like keep feeding the dog every time it wants food, and the dog can get really fat and unhealthy. In the wild, instincts and the contingencies of nature help to take care of that. And of course, the animals that aren't healthy end up dying and not passing on their genes, etc. So flourishing, bodily flourishing and bodily pleasure is going to be the highest, as it were, happiness of a dog or of any non-rational animal. What's interesting is that this also gives us a clue as to why it's not a contradiction that we put dogs to sleep when their health has deteriorated, but we don't do that to human beings. Why? Well, the highest happiness of a dog is the happiness of the body, the pleasures of the body. And so once the dog becomes incapable of that kind of happiness, the dog is incapable of happiness simply. There's nothing else for the dog. And so the dog, that's the entire value, you might say, to the dog of its life. That's not the case for humans, which is what we're going to get to in a minute. So this is a difference. Why euthanizing dogs makes sense on a Thomistic understanding, but not human beings. Okay, so generally speaking, the happiness for a dog is going to be, so at a high level, happiness for a dog is going to be acting according to their powers in a rightly ordered way, according to these powers, sense knowledge and sense appetite. Okay, so now let's get to the human being. How are we different? So we have all this, right? We have these powers as well. We have bodies and we have all the organs of other animals. This is why, you know, we are animals. This is why Aquinas insists that Aquinas' understanding of what a human being is not, as sometimes you hear people say, an incarnate spirit or, you know, a sort of soul in a body, but we are rational animals. That's the rational part that sets us apart. So we have, in addition to these powers here, the powers of the intellect and the will and their respective objects. So intellectual powers. Okay, these are the intellect and the will. Now notice that I put these under truth and goodness, under the cognitive and appetitive powers, because this is another kind of cognitive power, knowing power, and this is another kind of desiring power. Okay, now, what are their objects? Well, here it is, universal truth. And the good as good. So, what do we mean by universal truth? How is this different from the senses? Well, so my senses can see the banana, and I might even respond to it as, you know, if I'm a monkey, I know that this is tasty. I know what they look like. I recognize it as a tasty thing, and I go after it. What the intellect does is it can classify it. It can recognize it as banana and recognize other things like it as bananas, as having the same nature as this thing.
And so we can bring under, with the intellect, we can bring particular things under what we call universal concepts. Okay? This, in some ways, a dog can behave like it recognizes universal things. But the dog is just responding to its senses. Because the dog has memory and has imagination, can remember the way that the steak tasted before, and can go after it. But humans, and this is why language is possible for us, we can think about the banana in a universal way. So think about language for a second. The word banana doesn't just correspond to this. It corresponds to the bunch that I took it out of, you know, out in the refectory. It corresponds to every other banana in the world. And that's that word, and we understand the word. When I use the word, you know what I'm saying. That word has a universal meaning. It's not just talking about a particular. Whereas all the knowledge of the dog, all the knowledge of a non-rational animal, it's just particular. It's not universal. And so I can know bananas as such with my intellect. I can also know good as such. Whereas the senses could recognize sense goods, right? Or really, you know, I smell the donut and my desire just goes after that, right? The intellect, on the other hand, can recognize the good as such. And so because we have intellect, we can do something that the dog doesn't do. So I see the donut, I smell the donut, and I want it. I feel pulled to it by my senses. But my intellect judges, well, you already had a half a donut at lunch. That's really enough. And like, you know, you don't need to gain any more weight right now, which is something that those of us who spend a lot of time at our desk tend to do, right? You don't need to gain any more weight right now. And in fact, like, it would be good for you spiritually as well. You know, as Professor Kazor was saying, like, sometimes we need to say no to those desires. And so I can decide with my intellect that overall, all things considered, better not to take the donut. Now, what does my will do? Well, the will is the intellectual appetite. And so it responds to reasons that it's given by the intellect. Okay, and the intellect can consider many different reasons. One reason the intellect can consider is, what is better for me spiritually? Here's another reason the intellect can consider. What tastes better? Right? So bodily pleasures can be one of the things, one of the goods that the intellect considers. And what the intellect presents to the will is, well, what's the best choice here? And that's what the will desires. Now, it's not quite that simple, in fact, but that's a sort of, you might say, toy case. It kind of makes the will sound mechanical. So the intellect thinks about it and says, oh, this is the best thing. And the will's like, okay, let's do that. So it's not quite that simple because, if you remember here, the will is an efficient cause. The intellect is a final cause. Because the intellect's a knowing power, the will is a desiring power. Now, as it happens here, and this doesn't happen with the appetite so much, with the bodily appetite so much, my bodily appetite can make me lean towards to get more of the scent, right? It can affect my knowing powers to some extent. But here, the will can actually respond to the intellect and in the following way. So let's say my will is used to getting what it wants when it comes to donuts. Like when I smell a donut, that affects me really strongly. So the intellect says, hey, you know, here's the good of the pleasure, and then here's also the good of fasting. My will can be trained to say, oh, intellect, think more about the pleasure. Let's not think about the fasting. And the will can actually change the way in which the intellect thinks. Okay, so, I mean, you can think about, like an easy example of this. So, Steve Jensen uses the example of, this involves only indirectly bodily pleasure. But you go to the bank, and the person at the bank gives you an extra $20 bill when he gives you your change. So you have a moment to say, well, I could get, you know, an extra meal and I'm really in a hurry. I really should get some fast food. It would make my afternoon much easier with this extra $20 bill. But my intellect also knows it would be wrong to keep this. On some level, I mean, all of us just kind of intuitively know that you should give it back. But, you know, my will, which is attached to the bodily pleasure of getting fast food, something like that, with a $20 bill,
My will really fixates on that. And the will doesn't think, but the will can sort of, as it were, nudge the intellect towards real thoughts. Like, well, I mean, it was her mistake that she gave me the extra 20. I mean, come on. The bank has plenty of money. Right? And, you know, I've really had a difficult time lately, and et cetera, et cetera. So the way in which we think about what is the overall best thing to do with our intellect can be affected by our passions and the way in which our will responds to our passions. Now, this is called rationalization, okay? And it's why you do evil knowingly. Like, sometimes we do evil accidentally. It's possible to not know that you were doing that, or to not clearly know that you were doing something wrong. But this sort of interaction between the intellect and will explains why we can actually do something that we regret later, and that we knew very well at the time, if we're honest with ourselves, what's wrong. So the other example that Aquinas gives is the example of a man committing adultery. Okay, and so here's a case where he knows that this is contrary to the law of God, right? But the pleasure is very attractive. And so what you can have is this interplay between the intellect and the will, where the will, which is not, as it were, trained to be okay with resisting this kind of pleasure, the will can sort of push our intellect to focus on the pleasure. Let's think about that and not pay attention to this other stuff. And so as a result, because probably in this case, because the person's passions are out of line, because the person is not used to not choosing pleasure, right? And because the will is habituated to be attracted more to the pleasure presented to it by the intellect than to the law of God, the man actually ends up committing adultery. Notice that once the pleasure is gone, immediately there's remorse. Why? Because the pleasure was the only thing that could distract him from what he knew to be the wrong thing to do. Once that's gone, immediately he sees clearly that what I've done is evil. And so the important question to ask is, what is the right way for these powers to work together with each other? And for a human being, for a dog, the sum of the appetites is always going to determine what the dog does. For a human being, the action that we take always waits upon the consent of our will. Our will, no matter how strong our passions are, the will has the ability to decide contrary to them. Now, it can be if the passions are strong enough, and if the will is habituated to not acting against the passions, it can be very, very, very difficult. And so in cases of addiction, right, in particular, you see this, where it's almost as though the person has no will. I think we believe the person is still human, and therefore they do have a will. But their will has been, as it were, crippled. So one of the things to ask is, given all of this, what does happiness look like? What does living well look like? Because ultimately, Aristotle thinks a human being is going to be happy if we live as a good human being would live. We're going to be happy if we live well according to the kind of thing that we are. And he reasons that that's going to be different for us than it's going to be for other sorts of animals, precisely because we have different powers that are distinctive of us. We're going to need to act according to those highest parts of us. And so what does that mean? Well, it means choosing, first of all, reasoning and choosing according to reason. But how is the best way to do that? Well, one way to do it is to have passions that are going crazy all the time and just to have iron strength to see the good and for the intellect to, you know, be steadfast in showing what is truly good to the will, and the will does it, and we overcome every time, and everyone is happy, and the peasants rejoice. But that's not realistic. It would be much easier if we could become habituated to choosing correctly, right? And if our emotions were not, our passions were not all over the place. So obviously I have enough temperance that I haven't actually eaten the donut while I've been speaking, right? So there's at least a little bit of a habit of like, maybe it's because it would be embarrassing if I were trying to eat the donut while I was speaking. But there's at least a little bit of a habit of resisting that passion and ordering that passion correctly in me, I hope. But we can see, first of all, that like that's one of the things that we're going to need is the ability to subordinate these desires to what reason says. And what Aristotle observes is, look, the more you resist the donut, this donut and the next donut and the following donut, the easier it's going to be for your passions to, as it were, not expect the donut. Like, not expect you to eat a donut anytime one is in front of you. And that's what we call virtue. Specifically, that will be the virtue of temperance. Now, for Aristotle, virtue is always going to be a kind of middle way between extremes, a mean. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that he says, look, our tendency is usually to go to extremes. And it's usually to go to extremes in one direction. So in the case of temperance, usually the problem is we want too much pleasure. But Aristotle says, you know, it could also be possible to like just like ignore pleasure and not want enough of it for a good human life. And so it's not that we refuse pleasures of the body with the virtue of temperance. So I should write the name of the virtue over here. Temperance. Moderates pleasure. Bodily pleasure. So it's not that we refuse all pleasures of the body, but we put them in their proper place. And so this is going back to really to the different levels of happiness, right? We don't subject a more important good to the good of the body. And if I become so obsessed with bodily pleasure that that's the main thing I want in life, like I'm at work all day and all I'm thinking about is the donuts I'm going to have at the end of the day, right? That's what monopolizes my attention. That's what I live for, as it were. Clearly, I've gone way past the place of temperance. And so all of the virtues are going to be moderating something. So then you have the virtue of fortitude. So this is a virtue where these are virtues of the passions. So fortitude is a virtue that moderates our fear, particularly fear against bodily harm. So fortitude is just courage. Now, of course, traditionally in the ancient world, this was thought to be mainly like the special virtue of a soldier. I think now we can certainly apply it to other things where we're maybe not directly fearing death, but we're fearing humiliation, we're fearing losing our job, things like this. It's the virtue by which we use fear in an ordered way, in a rational way. Now, these are virtues of the emotions because they fundamentally affect how our emotions pull us. If you have the virtue of temperance, you're not going to be tempted to overeat. You're not going to be tempted, or not very much, to eat the donut when you've already had one. You're not going to be tempted to commit adultery. And the reason is just because your body isn't pulling you towards those things. And when it comes to bodily pleasure, right, it's usually our bodily passions that are tempting us towards it. Likewise, the fortitude. You're going to be able to push through when you need courage to accomplish something. You're going to be able to push through. And the fear won't be overwhelming. Okay, so those are virtues of the emotions. We also need a virtue by which we do right by other people. So human beings are social animals. And we need to give each person his due, as it were. And that is the virtue of justice. So, and this is a virtue of the will. So it affects, as it were, so our will doesn't think, it's our intellect that thinks, but the will can pull towards one thing more strongly than another thing. And in this case, when we have the virtue of justice, we, you know, and we're given a decision to make that involves what we owe to others around us. Our will gravitate towards the choices that we can make that draw us towards justice, towards doing right by other people, even if we have to sacrifice bodily pleasure
right? Even if we have to sacrifice our time, our effort, you know, our own pleasure for the sake of it. And then the fourth of the traditional moral virtue is prudence. I was talking with a few of you at lunch about this. This is a virtue of the intellect. Prudence is sometimes called the gatekeeper of the virtues. And what prudence does is, so the virtue of prudence is what allows me to apply the virtues in concrete situations. So the conversation we were having was actually about, you know, so you're headed to daily mass and a friend needs your help. Now, one thing you could do in that situation is you'd think, well, objectively, mass is more important than anything else because it's God, like Christ himself comes to us in the mass. And so in that situation, I should tell my friend, you know, sorry, I can't help you right now. I have to go to mass because that's the objectively better good. Right? Now, you might think, well, doesn't that depend on like how urgent it is? Because like if I miss daily mass, I'm not like losing my obligation, but it's objectively higher, right? This is a situation, one of almost like the vast majority of situations in life where some kind of objective rule doesn't determine what you're supposed to do. Right. This is where the virtue of prudence comes in. And you say, well, what overall is the best thing for me to do in this situation? And prudence helps you to do that. Yeah, so the prudence is the highest of the moral virtues in the eyes of Aquinas and Aristotle. Because it really, ultimately, the purpose of virtues is not just to have virtue. The purpose of virtues is to act well. So for Aristotle, the definition of the human end is action according to virtue. And so acting according to virtue. It's not just having virtue. Because Aristotle says, look, a sleeping person has virtue, right? And a sleeping person isn't necessarily happy just because they have virtue. A human being is happy when they act according to virtue. When they act according to their powers, well-ordered in the right way. So, and living out these virtues is what gives us the kind of harmony within ourselves. The harmony within ourselves that allows us to, in this life, attain, you know, as much happiness as is possible to us. Now, let me just end by saying something very quickly about what faith in Christ adds to this. So, in Christ, God has become one of us. And he's brought his love into the world, demonstrated through his passion and death, and overcome death in his resurrection. And this love is a redeeming love. What we mean by that is it has the ability to draw us into friendship with God when we've been alienated from him due to sin. We become children of God through baptism. And through the sacraments, and this is something that I think, you know, Dr. Kayser and I are philosophers, so we don't always talk about this side of things, but it's a reality in the life of a Christian that grace is crucial. Not just in our pious actions or actions in church, but grace is crucial in our moral life. Like, I mean, Aquinas thinks that we have infused versions of these virtues that God gives us in order that we might live the life he created us to live. And that ultimately, you know, without me, you can do nothing, the Lord tells us. And then, of course, we have the theological virtues, which I can't really go into right now, but faith, hope, and charity, which are all, they're called theological because they're all directed towards God, towards belief in God, towards hoping in our eternal salvation, and towards the love of God, and through God, the love of neighbor. And then, as we know, the other thing that the coming of Christ gives us is it gives us the ability to really fulfill what all this is pointing towards. So Aristotle noticed that like even the person who's really virtuous goes through life, they're also subject to the contingencies of life. How can they have a more stable happiness than the one that's subject to, you know, just accidents of disease and calamity? And one of the things that Aristotle says, and you know, it's controversial exactly how among scholars, how this fits in with action according to virtue. But he says that in a way, the highest happiness is contemplation of truth. It's not clear, and I'm not an Aristotle scholar myself, but it's not clear exactly how that's supposed to fit in with this. But they go together, in ourselves mind.
For Aquinas, though, this is obvious because ultimately the contemplation of truth is the contemplation of God, which we experience finally in the beatific vision. I'm going to stop there and go ahead and take questions. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.